but it had never budged from its geostationary orbit above the Makassar Strait, and no one in Blue really knew how soon it might become operational. The Great Chain, as the rotating city was called, lined a circular opening, like an iris, in the middle of the eye. To either side of it, the eye tapered to a point. One of those points was always aimed toward the center of Earth, and the other was always aimed away from it. A cable, or rather a redundant, self-healing network of them, emerged from each of those two points. The inner one hung almost all the way down to the Earth's surface, where a thing called cradle dangled from it. The outer cable stretched for some distance beyond the habitat ring and terminated in the big rock, which served as a counterweight. By adjusting the length of the latter cable, it was possible to move the whole construct's center of gravity closer to or farther away from Earth, causing it to speed up or slow down in its orbit relative to the habitats in the ring. Thus, it could sweep around like the hand of a clock, passing around each habitat along the way, or pausing for a time as needed. And when it was encircling a particular habitat, it could easily exchange people and goods with it, via flivvers, or cargo shuttles, or swarms of gnats, or mechanical contraptions that could snake out like tentacles. To be in a habitat, even a quite large and cosmopolitan one, when the eye came around was, in pre-zero terms, a little bit like being in a small town on the prairie and having a mobile Manhattan suddenly roll over the horizon, surround you, have 100 kinds of intercourse with you, and then move on. Among its many other functions, it was a passenger ferry, the most straightforward way of moving among habitats. This was why Cath 2 needed to remind herself of where it was at the moment and which direction it was moving. The answer was that it was about 20 degrees west of their projected apogee, encircling a large new habitat called Akureyri, and heading generally in the direction of the Cape Verde boneyard that separated the Greenwich segment from the Rio segment, which meant that it would soon be in the predominantly Ivan part of the ring. "Whip over high and catch the eye?" she asked. This amounted to a proposal that they should avail themselves of a kind of huge aluminum bullwhip, a very common device on the ring, to project their flivver into a higher orbit. As they curved slowly through apogee out beyond the ring, everything below them, the entire contents of the habitat ring, including the eye, would speed past them on the inside track, so that by the time they looped back to it, the eye would have caught up with them. They could dock their flivver to any of its hundreds of available ports, pass through quarantine in relative comfort, and go their separate ways, using the eye as a ferry to take them wherever they wanted to go, or as a transit hub where they could change to passenger flivvers or liners that might transport them more directly to other places in the system. Or they could ride the elevator down to cradle. Or they could just remain on the eye, a habitat in its own right, where many people lived their entire lives. When possible, catching the eye was almost always preferable to ending up on some random habitat whence it might take days or even weeks to get transit onward, and so proposals like this one were rarely controversial. "Works for me," Rhys said immediately. Cath 2 glanced toward Belid and saw him looking back at her. She understood that the Teclan had, in a manner unchanged through thousands of years of racial subspeciation and acculturation to the social and cultural environment of space, been checking her out. She raised an eyebrow at him, just slightly.
"Of course," said Belid.
"Unanimous. I'll punch it in," Rhys announced, and went to work at the interface panel. Cath, too, had felt a mildly embarrassing, faint tingle between her legs, a sort of blush, accompanied by a bit of warmth in the face. She expected that Belid was reciprocating at some level. But Teclans were trained not to show their feelings, out of a belief, supposedly traceable all the way back to the ancient Spartans, that emotions such as fear resulted from their visible expression, rather than the other way around. Perhaps sensing what was going on between Cath 2 and Belid, Rhys focused on his task somewhat more intently than was really needed. The complications, as always, had to do with avoiding collisions and respecting what was still called airspace around habitats, even though it had no air in it and might more properly have been called space space. Kath, too, keeping half an eye on the brief and businesslike conversation between Rhys and Perambulator, which to her eyes had nothing whatsoever in common with whatever was meant by punching it in, but this was just how Dynans liked to express themselves, saw that they would pass through the 20-kilometer-wide gap between habitats named Saint-Exupéry and Knut-Tolman. Midway between them was a whip station. Almost every habitat of significance was bracketed between two of these installations. The whip stations were small habitats, crewed by half a dozen or so humans who got rotated out every few months so they would not go crazy from boredom. Their job was to look after thousands of Flinks, the latest generation of a lineage of robots that went all the way back to Rhys Aitken's work aboard Izzy. He had been working with fingernail-sized gnats. The ones on whip stations performed the same functions, but they were much bigger. The chains that they formed had the mass and momentum of pre-zero freight trains, capable of undulating and cracking like a whip, or reaching out at distant targets like the fly on the end of a fishing line. Some wear and tear was involved. Flinks could have been inspected and repaired by other robots, but Blue's overall cultural bias in favor of having humans in the loop had led to much of the work being done by flesh and blood crew members. In any case, supposing those people had been doing their job, keeping their fleet of Flinks ready for use, and assuming that no other space travelers had already reserved that time slot on that whip station, the flivver carrying Kath II, Rhys, and Bellet would, in something like 12 hours' time, rendezvous with the tip of an aluminum bullwhip that would then snap it into a circular orbit with a slightly higher radius than that of the ring. A few hours later, they would dock at Port 65 in the quarantine section of the outer limb of the Eye. The Eye observed whatever time was local on the part of Earth lying directly below it. Currently, it was about 8 in the morning there. She could look forward to some serious jet lag, another term from the pre-zero era that had become embedded in the language, despite the obsolescence of its literal meaning. According to one convention, they should switch over to Eye time now, so that they could begin adjusting. But they had all finished long days on New Earth, and were too exhausted at this moment to maintain the pretense that it was first thing in the morning for them. They would have plenty of time to adjust in quarantine. Kath, too, reserved a Moiran-friendly bed and meal plan at Port 65, then plummeted into sleep. The iris of the Eye was too big to have been fabricated as a single rigid object. It had been built, beginning about 900 years ago, out of links that had been joined together into a chain, the two ends of the chain then connected to form a loop. The method would have seemed familiar to Rhys Aitken, who had used something like it to construct Izzy's T3 Taurus. For him, or anyone else versed in the technological history of Old Earth, an equally useful metaphor would have been that it was a train, 157 kilometers long, made of 720 giant cars, with the nose of the locomotive joined to the tail of the caboose so that it formed a circular construct 50 kilometers in diameter. An even better analogy would have been to a roller coaster, since its purpose was to run loop-the-loops forever. The track on which the train ran was a circular groove in the iron frame of the Eye, lined with the sensors and magnets needed to supply electrodynamic suspension, so that the whole thing could spin without actually touching the Eye's stationary frame. This was an essential design requirement, given that the great chain had to move with a velocity of about 500 meters per second in order to supply Earth-normal gravity to its inhabitants. Each of the links had approximately the footprint of a Manhattan City block on Old Earth, and their total number of 720 was loosely comparable to the number of such blocks that had once existed in the gridded part of Manhattan, depending on where you drew the boundaries. It was bigger than Midtown, but smaller than Manhattan as a whole. Residents of the Great Chain were acutely aware of the comparison, to the point where they were mocked for having a Manhattan complex by residents of other habitats. They were forever freeze-framing Old Earth movies or zooming around in virtual reality simulations of pre-zero New York for clues as to how street and apartment living had worked in those days. They had taken as their patron saint Louisa, the eighth survivor on Cleft, a Manhattanite who had been too old to found her own race. Implicit in that was that the Great Chain, the GC, Chain Town, Chain Hatton, was a place that people might move to when they wanted to separate themselves from the social environments of their home habitats, or indeed of their own races. Mixed-race people were more common there than anywhere else. As in Manhattan, the discretization of the space imposed form on how it had developed, with each link of the chain, each city block, acquiring its own skyline and identity. Groups of consecutive blocks had long since coalesced into neighborhoods. Each block was, in effect, a fully independent space vehicle with its own system for keeping the air from leaking out. But each was connected to its two neighbors by a bundle of passageways routed through its foundation slab, which made it possible to move easily from one to the next in the same way that the Londoners of old Earth had used underground passages, subways, in the London sense of the word, to cut beneath crowded intersections. Some of the subways were sized for human pedestrians. Four of them carried trains, locals and express service running both directions around the full circuit of the Great Chain. Still others were reserved for robotic vehicles programmed to carry cargo. Beyond that was a wide range of smaller conduits carrying air, water, power, and information. All of them went by the name of subways. This was a conflation of the old London and New York senses of the word. At each end of each block was a system of airlocks. These would seal themselves off in the event that a block were to depressurize. People ran marathons through them. Four consecutive marathons made up about one circuit around the entire chain. Every fifth link in the chain was public property. These tended to be parks, though some served as cultural facilities. So you were never more than two links away from green, or at least open, space. The other 576 links were privately owned, and constituted a commercial and residential real estate market that would have been easily recognizable to any pre-zero property magnate. The Great Chain had been likened more than once to the ancient board game of Monopoly. Some stretches of the loop were more high rent, others less so. The pattern was interrupted in several places by special links, or short series of links, placed there to serve industrial and civic requirements, such as making the transit system work. One of those was the ramp link, whose purpose was to make connections every 5 minutes with the on-ramp and the off-ramp. Since the Great Chain was moving at about 500 meters per second with respect to the non-rotating frame of the eye, persons wishing to get from the latter to the former needed to be accelerated to a fairly spectacular velocity, almost Mach 1.5, before they could set foot on the ramp or any other link. And those wishing to de-chain, as the expression had it, needed to be decelerated by the same amount. The acceleration and the deceleration were handled by machines built into a place on the rim of the iris of the eye. Though some efforts had been made to camouflage their essential nature, they were really just guns for shooting humans, albeit humans strapped into comfortable, pressurized bullets. Outside of the Great Chain, the rest of the eye was lightly infested with human beings, heavily so with robots. Most of it existed in microgravity, since the entire contraption, Great Chain, tethers and all, was in geosynchronous orbit, hence freefall around Earth. As you moved away from its center, toward the two extremities of the eye where the tethers emerged, you might begin to notice tidal forces, which would show up as very mild gravity-like tugs. These shifted whenever the eye adjusted its orbit to move around the habitat ring, and people who spent a lot of time there could always feel in their bones when a move was underway, like old earthers predicting the weather in their knees. The skeleton of the eye was a simple space frame built in the Amalthean style, which was to say that it had been carved and shaped from existing material, cleft, as opposed to fabricated from scratch. Aesthetically, it meant that the big structural elements had a rough-hewn, space-battered look to them, a bit like a log cabin with all the knots and bark still visible. Vacancies between the big structural elements had been filled in with giant machines, most notably several immense rotating masses whose purpose was to stabilize the whole eye gyroscopically. The nooks and crannies between the machines had been caulked with pressurized spaces where humans could move about. Some of those rotated to produce simulated gravity. They were like miniature torus-shaped space colonies pinned to a much bigger structure. Docking ports tended to cluster near those. As Cath-2's eyes closed into sleep, she was gazing at the usual ring-shaped formation of iridescent sparkles, so densely packed that they blended into each other on the VARP. The eye was a slightly larger white dot between 12 and 1 o'clock. It would have been difficult to see were it not for the long white line representing its tether system, which ran from just above the Earth's surface all the way through the big white dot and beyond to the big rock. Their flivver's trajectory, a sharp green ellipse, projected from where they were now, near Earth, all the way out to slightly beyond the ring before curving back in to intersect the eye. Through her eyelids, she could see indistinct patterns, reminding her a little of the first thing she'd seen this morning, the flickering lights on the walls of her tent. But then the VARP figured out that her eyes were closed and shut off the display. When she opened her eyes, the VARP noticed it and came back to life, rendering the display again. Generally, it looked the same, but the eye had moved a little bit, and the dot representing the flivver had covered most of the distance to the habitat ring. Zooming in, she could see the two habitats between which they were going to pass, and the much smaller rendering of the whip station between them, exercising its long, hair-thin flagellum in preparation for their arrival. She must have slept for something like 10 hours. Moirans were notorious for it. Remembering the look she had exchanged earlier with Belled, she felt, then stifled, mild embarrassment over the fact that she had spent most of the journey snoring away. She unstrapped and floated over to the zero-G toilet at the end of the flivver's cabin. When she emerged a few minutes later, she saw that Reese was asleep, loosely strapped in before the control panel. Belled was still in his acceleration couch. He too had slipped on a VARP, and she guessed from the way he was moving his hands and wiggling his fingers that he was working as opposed to playing. He was probably filling out his survey report, which was what Cath 2 ought to be doing. They represented a civilization that had, during the fourth millennium, executed a plan to undo the damage caused by the agent by identifying, cataloging, reaching, corralling, and re-vectoring millions of rocks in orbit around Earth, while also reaching as far as the Kuiper Belt to acquire chunks of frozen water and methane and ammonia and bring them home and smash them into the ruined planet. Essentially, all of this work had been accomplished by robots. So much metal had gone into their construction that millions of humans now lived in space habitats whose steel hulls consisted entirely of melted down and reforged robot carcasses. It would have been easy for them to blanket the surface of New Earth with robots and, without ever sending down a single human being, perform a kind of survey, one that was heavy on data and light on judgment. In that version of the world, Cath 2 and the others would have spent their lives in habitats, working at VARPs and mining data. All sorts of interesting philosophical arguments could have been framed as to whether that approach was better or worse than what they were in fact doing. But philosophy didn't really enter into it. The decision to do it this way was driven partly by politics and partly by social mores. On the political front, it boiled down to the terms of Second Treaty, which, 18 years ago, had terminated the Second Red-Blue War, sometimes called the War in the Woods, to distinguish it from the earlier War on the Rocks. The treaty imposed strict limitations on the number of robots that either side could send down to the surface. For that matter, it also limited the number of humans. But the upshot was that, given those limits, human surveyors could gather more useful information about conditions on New Earth than could robots beaming data up to the ring. On the social front, it was a question of amistics, which was a term that had been coined ages ago by a Moiran anthropologist to talk about the choices that different cultures made as to which technologies they would and would not make part of their lives. The word went all the way back to the Amish people of pre-Zero America, who had chosen to use certain modern technologies, such as roller skates, but not others, such as internal combustion engines. All cultures did this, frequently without being consciously aware that they had made collective choices. To the extent that Blue had a definable culture, it tended to view technological aids with some ambivalence, a state of mind boiled down into the aphorism, "Each enhancement is an amputation." This was not so much a definable idea or philosophy as it was a prejudice, operant at a nearly subliminal level. It was traceable to certain parts of the epic. In many of these, Tavistock Prowse played a role. He was seen as its literal embodiment in the sense that he had actually undergone a series of amputations and been consumed as food after throwing in his lot with the swarm. Blue saw itself, according to cultural critics, defined itself, as the inheritors of the traditions of endurance. By process of elimination, then, Red was the culture of the swarm. A century and a half ago, Red had sealed itself off behind barriers both physical and cryptographic, so not much was known of its culture, but plenty of circumstantial evidence suggested that it had different amistics from Blue. Specifically, the Reds were enthusiastic about personal technological enhancement. The upshot, here in the cabin of this flivver, was that the missions just concluded by Cath 2, Bellet, and Rhys had no value. In effect, they had never happened, until reports had been filed. And the reports could not simply consist of data dumps and pictures. Surveyors had to write actual prose. And the more judgment and insight were condensed into that prose, the more highly it was thought of by people like Doc, and increasingly, his senior students. Knowing that, Cath 2 had been writing her report since before her glider had touched down on a broad swath of grass a fortnight ago. What remained was some editing and a summary. This ought to have come easily. But half an hour after she pulled the document up on her VARP, she found herself gazing at it, unable to focus. "Bellet?" she finally said. Distinctly enough for him to hear it, not loud enough to wake up Rhys.
"Working on your report?" he asked.
He could see her and the rest of the cabin through the translucent light field of his VARP. He might have seen the movements of her hands, indicative of text entry. In any case, the question had a bit of an edge to it. Hours earlier, Bellet had noted some uncertainty in Cath 2's face. There was no telling, now, how long he'd been observing her through eyes screened by the VARP. "Did you see any indigens?" she asked him. He reached up and slid the VARP under the top of his head, a polite gesture.
"I planned my route to avoid a certain Riz," he said.
Registered Indigen Zone, a place listed by name in the treaty as a district where Sooners, people who had illegally gone to the surface ahead of schedule, were grandfathered in under the politely evasive term indigens and allowed to live subject to certain restrictions.
"I saw it from a distance. They did not see me."
"Of course not," Cath 2 said, suppressing a smile.
"Does that answer your question?"
Bellet asked, knowing that it didn't. "I think I saw one not in a Riz," Cath 2 said. This piqued Bellet's attention.
"Establishing a settlement, or—"
"No," Cath 2 said firmly. "I'd have mentioned that. I think he or she was in scope." Meaning, conducting activities, such as hunting and gathering, within the scope of Second Treaty. "Most likely fishing, but at least 200 kilometers from the nearest Riz."
"A long way to carry a dead fish," Bellet remarked.
"Yeah," Cath 2 said, and felt her face warm slightly. Obvious as it seemed now that Bellet had pointed it out, she'd missed that detail.
"Did you investigate further?"
Bellet asked. "Unable," Cath 2 said. "I saw this person from my glider on my way out."
"It is not mandatory to explain every last thing in your report," Bellet pointed out. "To leave a loose end under those circumstances is acceptable. It will give some other surveyor a challenging and welcome task to shoulder." An idea came to Kath, too.
What if we were shouldering it?
Explain.
Does it seem to you as though there was an unusual concentration of survey activity in that one zone?
Unusual? Bellet allowed, after thinking about it for a few moments. Not without precedent.
Makes me wonder, Kath Two said, if some previous surveyor saw what I saw and triggered a wave of missions in the same area.
In that case, Bellet pointed out, survey would have informed us of what it was they were sending us to look for. That was so sensible, and Bellet said it with such simple conviction that Kath Two nodded and declined to press it any further. But she was thinking, unless it is something they don't want us to know.
The conversation with Bellet had been useful in that it had given her a way to proceed, which was simply to type up the indigent sighting as a loose end, and thus drop it into the lap of whoever read the report. She went to work on that general plan, trying to clarify the fleeting memory in her mind's eye, to sort out objective observations made in the moment from judgments and suppositions she had added later, which was tricky, since the latter was supposed to be part of her job. A while later, Reese was awakened by an alarm he'd set on his wrist. He made a sleepy flight to the toilet and back, looking at her in the classic style of the extrovert who wants you to drop whatever you're doing so that you can have a conversation with him. After exchanging a few words with Bellet, he settled into work on his own report, and the cabin was quiet for a while. Later the two men broke out some rations and had a snack, talking of this and that. Kath, too, was snapped out of her work reverie by a mild shift in their tone of voice. Now they were talking about something important, not in an urgent or concerned way. A glance at the display told her what it was. They were nearing the ring, which meant that they were about to lance through the 20-kilometer-wide gap between two space habitats. There was no reason that this should be a problem, but it was the sort of feat that focused one's attention and brought a discernible edge to one's voice. She reached up and found the lever on her VARP that activated an opaque screen over the lenses, essentially a blindfold. Her view of the cabin was now blocked. The only thing she could see were those being projected into her eyes by the VARP. At the same time, she activated an application that gave her the ability to see the flivver's surroundings as if she were floating adrift in space. The same service could have been provided by a bubble of glass on the flivver's hull, but it wouldn't have been as good. It would have exposed the user's head to cosmic radiation, and the contrasty light would have made it difficult to see certain things. The VARP, on the other hand, played games with the light's dynamic range so that bright things were less so while dim things were bright enough to see. It gave everything a luminous, warm quality that did not exist in reality. It was so far superior to looking at the world directly that many spacesuits eschewed transparencies altogether and just encased the wearer's head in a radiation-shielded dome with a VARP on the inside. She was now looking at an enhanced view of the universe from their current location, which was just inside, but rapidly approaching, the habitat ring. The ring was spinning past them. It was a little like being on the inside of a carousel, watching the horses wheel by, except that instead of horses, these were space habitats, as much as 30 kilometers across, and they were moving at 3,000 meters per second. The task was to shoot between two of them without getting hit. By the standards of orbital mechanics, it was no great feat, but it looked shockingly dangerous, and as such, it was great fun to watch. As Kath Two looked straight ahead, the habitats seemed to be whizzing across their path like the teeth of a buzzsaw. But through an apparent miracle, the flivver found a gap between two of them.
"Whip dock in three," announced a synthesized voice, and Kath Two's hands moved around to check the straps holding her into her seat. An immense bullwhip was burgeoning toward them. Its general dimensions were about those of an exceptionally long old Earth freight train, but instead of boxcars, it was made up of many flinks coupled nose to tail into a chain. If Reese's earlier preparations had gone according to plan, and Kath Two would have heard about it, were that not the case, then several hours ago, the hundreds of flinks that lived in this whip station had begun to assemble themselves into a chain. When it had reached the desired length, which was a function of the specific mission to be performed, the chain had joined itself nose to tail into an endless loop and gone into motion, driven by a simple linear motor in the whip station. It had formed an elongated oval known as an Aitken loop, and then devoted some time to tweaking its shape and dialing in its exact velocity. Flinks were simple beasts, consisting mostly of structure, solid aluminum cast into certain shapes. Each flink had a knuckle amidships, enabling it to bend freely in both directions. In mechanical engineering terms, it was just a heavy-duty universal joint. Fore and aft, it had couplers that enabled it to form a strong, rigid connection with other flinks. Somewhere in all of that structure were a few grams of silicon that made it smart, and lines for carrying power and information down the length of the chain. A few moments ago, word had gone out to one of the flinks that it should decouple from the one behind it. This had happened just as it was emerging from the whip station. At the instant the coupler had disconnected, the system had stopped being an Aitken loop and started being a giant bullwhip. The Nixht, a very old mispronunciation of Knixtela, referring to the U-shaped bend at the apex of the loop, had begun to propagate away from the whip station, towing the free end of the whip behind it, accelerating as it went, and rapidly building to thousands of meters per second of velocity. This was the thing Cath 2 saw in the VR, the elbow in the whip, coming right at them. The free end was concealed behind it, but she knew that in a few moments it would come whipping around in a huge final burst of acceleration. All the energy was directed backward, from the point of view of the bored crew members, who were presumably monitoring all of this in the station at the handle end of the whip. They were moving a lot faster than the flivver. In order to make physical contact with the approaching craft, they had to reach back. And reach wasn't really the right term. They had to punch backward with explosive suddenness to match the flivver's much lower velocity. This was the kind of task that bullwhips were made for. Still, she couldn't help but flinch as the final few flinks snapped around toward them. The perspective on the VR was almost sickening. The eye was confused by the fact that the whip as a whole was moving away from them so rapidly, and yet its uncoiling tip was coming right at them. Any failure in the calculations, and it would have either hurtled away from them, leaving them alone and adrift, or else smashed into them at hypersonic closing velocity and destroyed them as surely as a bolide strike during the epic. Instead of which, the two velocities matched perfectly, and the last flink in the chain was, just for a moment, right there in front of them, much like the hangar she had docked with earlier. "Coupling," said the voice, unnecessarily, since she could hear the mechanical connection being made and then feel the acceleration as the flivver was slapped sideways and then jerked forward by the momentum of the whip. "Brace for stabilization." A polite way of saying that the situation in the whip was a little chaotic in the aftermath of the snap round. In general, they were now being pulled forward with tremendous force, being brought up to a speed to match that of the whip station and all the other objects in the habitat ring. But the physics of the whip led to some side-to-side oscillation, some surges and lapses in the acceleration that could be dampened but not removed by the tiny adjustments of the flinks. "Habel has toggled," the voice confirmed. Habel, like Knixtela, was a term from the German. It was a lever at the base of the whip, anchored to the whip station, and capable of flipping freely from one side to the other. It was, in effect, the arm that held the handle and cracked the whip. And shortly after the completion of the first crack, the one that had culminated in successful docking, it had snapped around to the other side of the station and initiated a second crack in the opposite direction. A new Nixht had been formed, just at the place where the whip was attached to the Habel and was beginning to accelerate forward, accelerating the flivver to the velocity it would need to accomplish the rest of the mission. The process lasted for about 3 minutes. The visual cues in her headset gave her mind the context, the buzzsaw whirling past them seemed to slow down. Of course it was still moving at the same speed. In truth, the flivver was speeding up to match its pace. But from her point of view, the habitat ring stopped looking like a whirling dervish and began to resolve itself into a series of discrete objects, still rushing past them, but more and more slowly, until the whole ring seemed to grind to a halt. And at that moment, something especially huge drifted into view. The eye, dead in their path. "Decoupling," the voice announced, and not a moment too soon, since the acceleration had become difficult to tolerate. Had they not broken their connection to the tip of the whip, the G-forces would have rendered them unconscious, then killed them, and finally ripped the flivver to shreds. Flinks were built to survive forces that humans and ordinary spacecraft could not. But the geometry and the timing of the Nixht had been programmed so that it would bring them to their desired velocity and release them into their new trajectory just before the crisis that, in an old Earth bullwhip, would have been signaled by the sharp bang of a sonic boom. Weightlessness returned, unless you counted a bit of corrective jostling from the flivver's thrusters. Cath-2's vision cleared, and she swallowed a few times, trying to settle her stomach. The funny thing was that the entire procedure, from Cath-2's landing her glider in the hangar to the Bolo release to the just-concluded interaction with the whip, would have looked graceful, even gentle, when viewed from a distance. In order to understand the sheer intensity of the acceleration and the jostling, you had to live through it. Trying to think about something other than her stomach, she took a good look at the eye. Right now it was encircling Akureyri, a big, population 1.1 million, newish, 84 years old, habitat, constructed in the style known informally as the double barrel, historically known as the O'Neill Island 3 type. It was two large cylinders, parallel to each other, rotating in opposite directions. Each was enshrouded in complexes of mirrors and other infrastructure. The mirrors were aimed at the sun, whose light was bounced through windowed strips on the cylinder walls to illuminate the landscapes within. But it was about 6 in the evening local time, and so those mirrors were gradually being feathered to simulate twilight. By using the VARP to zoom in, Cath-2 could have peered through the windows to see the farms, forests, waterways, and habitations inside Akureyri. But she knew generally what it would look like, so she remained zoomed out for now. Which she had to, if she was going to take in the eye. Akureyri, big as it was dwarfed by the construct surrounding it. Of this, the most eye-catching part was the Manhattan on a roller coaster spectacle of the Great Chain, whipping around at terrific speed, completing a full circuit every 5 minutes. But that wasn't where they were going. As the eye became larger and larger in her view, its whirling iris drifted to one side, and it became clear that the flivver's tiny corrective burns had aimed them toward one of those inhabited bits contained within its massive, pitted iron frame, a ring of 40 docking ports encircled by a large, glowing yellow letter Q that was universally recognizable as the logo and the badge of Quarantine. At a glance, 2/3 of the ports in the Q were already occupied by other ships, mostly flivvers of various types plus a couple of liners. The ports were individually numbered with glowing digits and annotated in the mixture of Latin and Cyrillic used throughout the ring as to their purposes. Transit, immigration, military, survey, spiets. A ring of green lights surrounding a vacant port, number 65, began to flash. The systems that were controlling the flivver already knew where to go, so this was solely for the benefit of human beings, as well as serving as a backup plan in the rare event that a vehicle needed to be piloted by hand. Cath-2 had seen enough dockings in her time, so she peeled off the VARP and held it in her lap, through the ensuing series of nudges and jerks, which terminated with the opening of the airlock door. A yellow-striped tube stretched away into the part of Quarantine set aside for people who, like them, were returning from the surface of Earth. A few meters in, they were confronted by a one-way door, constructed so that only one person at a time could pass through it. Hanging on a rack nearby were a number of hard bracelets, color-coded to indicate that they were intended for survey personnel, also striped with machine-readable glyphs. Cath 2 selected one and ratcheted it around her wrist. After a moment, a red diode began to blink on its back and digits began to count time. She waved it at the door, which unlocked itself and allowed her to pass into the tube beyond. This part of the queue consisted essentially of plumbing, a snarl of human-sized pipes that drained people away from incoming ships and let them pool in separate reservoirs until they had passed muster. Cath 2, Reese, and Bellet would be inspected visually for invasive species and pathogens, their clothes and equipment sterilized. There would be mandatory showers and scrubbings. Stool and blood samples would be taken and tested. Because they were survey, however, little interest would be shown in their backgrounds, their politics, their emotional stability, their motivations. Survey personnel had already been vetted for that sort of thing. Depending on how busy the lab facilities were, it could take anywhere from 6 to 24 hours. The suspicion, followed by the certainty, that Cath 2 was being detained, crept up on her. After a few hours, she was given clearance to move freely about the common areas of the queue's no-man's land, eateries, shops, lounges, and recreational facilities strung around a torus with about half a G of simulated gravity. This meant that she had passed all the biological tests. But the bracelet continued to blink red. The digits counted up to a day, then a day and a half. She shifted her sleep schedule to eye time and began to experience jet lag. The queue was pretty crowded. Perhaps that figured into the delay. The eye had, in the last couple of weeks, swept westward across the oldest, most densely populated regions of the Greenwich segment, headed for the Cape Verde boneyard and the Rio segment beyond. At such a location, close to a boneyard where the habitats were big and new, the queue would expect to see a large volume of in-transit passengers, emigrants from older and more crowded places bound for big new habitats, like Akureyri. It took decades to fully populate one of those things. Their population was ramped up gradually as new housing was constructed and the life-supporting ecosystem was cultivated and tuned. In a short while, the eye would reach the Cape Verde boneyard, and the census in this place would drop to near zero. Just a few workers going to jobs on new habitats, and some patient long-range travelers. But for now, the facilities in the no-man's land were operating at capacity, and there were queues for food and drink, especially at places that catered to families. For people often emigrated when they had small children who they thought would benefit from being planted in a clean new place where they could run around. So Cath 2 told herself, for a while, that the delay was purely bureaucratic in nature, a result of too many emigrants and not enough queue staff on hand. But on the second day, she noticed Bellet in the recreation center, operating a resistance training device at some insane power level only usable by young male Teclans. Later, after he had showered, she caught up with him in a bar, and he mentioned that he had seen Reese headed for the exit, with his bracelet flashing green. "When was this?" she asked.
"Yesterday," Bellet said. 8 hours and 20 minutes after we docked."
A few hours later, Cath 2 and Bellet vacated their single rooms and moved into a slightly larger double. They began sleeping together without having sex, which was a fairly common behavior pattern for Moiran Teclan couples who scarcely knew each other. When Bellet got an erection, which was fairly often, he would go into the tiny ensuite bathroom and masturbate. This way of dealing with it was sufficiently common that for him to have behaved in any other way would have been noteworthy. She knew that she could rely on him to show impeccable discipline, and he knew that this was her expectation, and so it could go on indefinitely until one of them signaled a change. Unable to sleep, not as proficient as Bellet at masturbation, she heaved his massive arm off her chest, a project akin to dragging an unconscious 10-year-old boy to the other side of the bed, and slipped out, looking for a place to kill time until she felt drowsy. At the cafeteria, waiting in line for chocolate, she found herself standing next to a small, lithe Julian woman in her 60s. The woman had been reading a book, or pretending to. As the wait stretched on, she seemed to lose interest. She closed the book, stifled a yawn, and fixed her gaze on Kath too.
Back from the surface?
This was obvious from the color of Kath 2's wristband, but Kath 2 understood that the woman was just trying to strike up a conversation.
Yes. Home for you?
The woman asked, referring to the eye.
I'm sort of between homes at the moment. Survey duty makes it hard to settle down. Ah, taking a little R&R on the Great Chain. Good for you.
Kath, too, understood perfectly well that this woman was a quarantine agent. This was how the queue operated, not by interrogating you in a windowless room, but by striking up a casual conversation. The purpose of these common areas was to supply a range of venues and opportunities. It was important not to be seen as dissimulating, so Kath, too, said,
I expect some R&R might happen, but really I'm bound for Stromness. Ah, visiting a friend at university?
Was it telling the truth to call Doc a friend?
More of a mentor, a teacher, she said. Well, I've heard Stromness is lovely. Never been.
Many, perhaps most, who were probed in this way never even realized that they were talking to a quarantine agent. That was because most people passed through the queue rarely, if at all, and when they did, they tended to be jumbled together with large groups of travelers in settings where this sort of conversation might easily be mistaken for idle chit-chat. Kath, too, was a sufficiently experienced traveler to know exactly what was going on. And the other woman knew that she knew. They would carry on with the charade anyway. Kath, too, resisted the temptation to make trouble by asking the Julian where she had come from and where she was going. The woman would no doubt have some plausible story queued up. Obliging her to rattle it off would only waste time. As the queue crept forward, they came in view of a display panel above the counter, showing a scene from the epic. The time code in the corner was A+3.139, placing it about a year and a half into the big ride. The footage was from an arclet, not Endurance, so this was most likely from the swarm. There was simulated gravity, so the arclet had to be part of a bolo. Kath, too, didn't recognize any of the people at first. They were, of course, all rootstock humans, clearly recognizable as not belonging to any of the 7 current human races, but close enough that she could still feel what they were feeling. They spoke, like everyone else in the epic, in the archaic accents of 5,000 years ago. No Eves were currently in the frame. The only Eves in the swarm, of course, had been Julia and Aida. So this was probably what they called side story, which was to say, video from the epic that, while it didn't capture the words or the deeds of any of the Eves, was still deemed important enough to have been incorporated into the canon and to show up on playlists in locations like this cafe. Kath, too, had a vague sense that she had seen it before, many years ago, perhaps in school. She had lost track of days and time zones, but she was fairly sure that today was Jules Day, and so any epic scenes being broadcast in a place like this were most likely commemorative of something that Eve Julia had said or done.
Happy Eve Day, she said, as a polite reflex, to the Julian standing next to her.
Good day to you, the woman returned, which confirmed that today was in fact Jules Day. Kath, too, watched the scene long enough to get the gist of it. She was growingly certain that she remembered these people and their situation. The 7 fat and 7 thin was a bolo that had consisted of 2 heptads. One of them had experienced a breakdown in food production because of a contagious blight that had started in one of its arclets and eventually spread to the other 6. The result was 7 arclets full of starving people, connected by a long cable to 7 arclets in which there was plenty to eat. They had worked out a system of sending spacewalkers up their respective cables to the center point where the 2 paws were latched together. There, care packages from the 7 fat would be handed over to spacewalkers from the 7 thin, who would descend back to the afflicted heptad and distribute the food. But 7 arclets could not produce food for 14.
all went hungry, and people in the Seventh Fin began to die. The problem was exacerbated by the fact that this bolo had become separated from the main swarm. The particular scene now being broadcast was a video conference between the starvelings of the Seventh Fin and the only slightly better fed occupants of the Seventh Fat, made more wrenching by the fact that family members and old friends had found themselves separated by that cable. Kath, too, was sure she remembered it now. In a few minutes, they would establish radio contact with the White Arklet and bring Eve Julia into the conversation to ask for her advice. She would make a little speech about what they must do. The story would end with the Seven Fin cutting themselves loose from the bolo. They timed it in such a way that the Seven Fat would be flung back in the direction of the main swarm, ensuring their at least temporary survival, while the Seven Fin went hurtling away in the opposite direction. In effect, the doomed ones used themselves as propellant to save the others. The tale was made more complicated and more poignant by other details that Kath, too, would be subjected to if she stood here watching it long enough. The Seventh Fin Heptad was one of the few that contained part of the human genetic archive, and so its sacrifice had been part of the seemingly inexorable series of mishaps that had led to the Council of the Seven Eves and the creation of the new human races. And their decision to sacrifice themselves had not been unanimous. It had been preceded by a mutiny, and hand-to-hand fighting from one Arklet to the next as a minority of the starvelings had attempted to save themselves by donning spacesuits and ascending the cable. The man who had fought his way to the control panel and mashed the button that had severed the bolo was named Julius Mwangi. There was a habitat named after him at 38 degrees, 0 minutes east, hovering over his birthplace in Kenya. The 0 minutes part being significant, since habitats lying on meridians were traditionally named after heroes of the epic. All of that came back to Cathu's mind during the time it took the cafe workers to make her coffee. For, since it had become obvious that she was being interrogated, she thought it best to change her order from chocolate to something with a little more caffeine. "This is on me," she said to the quarantine agent, since it was traditional to do small favors for strangers on their eve day. Had this been Moyer's day, someone else might have paid for her coffee. "Oh, no, I couldn't," the woman said, which was probably true on a literal level. She could not accept a favor from someone she was interrogating. "But if you would allow me to sit with you?" "Of course," Kath, too, said, and waited while the woman's coffee was made. The screen above the counter had cut to a different part of the epic, consisting of a conversation that had taken place aboard Endurance, shortly before the final burn, in which Dinah and Ivy had talked each other into believing that Julia wasn't as bad as all that. Kath, too, had always found it a little cloying. People quoted lines from it all the time. It had served as the basis for political movements and parties that had sought to build stronger alliances between the Julians and other races. As such, its timing was fortuitous. Had Kath, too, been of a Julian turn of mind, she'd have wondered whether the whole thing had been staged, the playlist's timing rigged by someone behind the scenes at quarantine so that she would see it just before sitting down to coffee with this woman. Because that was how Julians were. It was the choice that Eve Julia had made during the Council of the Seven Eves. Her strain, living in relative isolation in their segment of the ring, had intensified it through the selective breeding process known as caricaturization. Julians had developed huge eyes, sleek ears, and small mouths as part of that. It was the single easiest way to identify one from across the room. The woman saluted before sitting down. Julians saluted with their left hands, keeping off to the side of the face so that the hand never passed through the eye line. "Ariane," she said. A common Julian name, derived from the rockets launched from Kourou, which Eve Julia had defended by nuking the Venezuelans. "Ariane Casablancova," meaning that she was the daughter of a woman named Casablanca, after the White House. Kath, too, saluted back. "Kath Amolthova, too." For Kath, too's mother had been named after the asteroid that had sheltered Moira and her lab, through the big ride. Ariane sat down across from her, huge eyes fixed impassively on Cath-2's face.
Look, Cath-2 said, I'm no good at this. I don't belong to any coupole, and I don't want to join. Just ask me what is on your mind.
Just wondering if you saw anything interesting on the surface.
My whole point in going there was to see interesting things. I hardly see anything that is not interesting.
Ariane just sat there expectantly.
I filed a report, Cath-2 said. And discussed its contents with Belid Tomov?
Yes.
But not with Rhys Alaskov.
Rhys was asleep when Belid and I were talking.
You slept quite a bit as well, Ariane remarked. 10 hours on the flivver.
I had been flying a glider all day.
With frequent naps.
Every time a Moiran sleeps in a little bit, Cath-2 said, it doesn't mean that we are going epi. Sometimes we are just tired is all.
Time will tell. Now you are journeying to have a face-to-face conversation with your mentor, Ariane said. Or so you think.
What does that mean?
Doctor Who is not on Stromness. You would know as much if you had coordinated with him. But you didn't. Instead, you made an impulsive plan, spur of the moment, to visit a place with which you have good associations. Something's troubling you. You are aware that you might be starting to go epi. You won't discuss it with Doc until you are face to face with him in a place where you feel safe. It must be something you observed on the surface. Something unexpected.
Telling Ariane Casablancova to read Cath-2's report wouldn't help. Probably she had already perused it several times. She wanted to hear the story fresh.
I might have seen a human, Cath-2 said.
Might? It was a glimpse from a distance.
Not another surveyor, or else you wouldn't see anything remarkable in it.
Surveyors wear bright clothes for visibility.
Belid didn't.
When he was passing near the Riz, no, of course not. I'm speaking in general.
Go on.
This person was wearing the opposite. Sort of like...
Like what?
You ever see pre-Zero videos with hunters? They used to wear clothes that would make them less visible.
Camouflage, Ariane said.
Yeah, I think this person was in camouflage.
Not a surveyor, then.
So military, perhaps? Cath-2 asked. But the only purpose of military is to fight other military. And I'm pretty sure there's no other military down there. Unless there's been some kind of infraction. But if there'd been an infraction, I'd have been warned of it before I was dropped. Hell, they'd have sent a Thor after me.
Did it occur to you that it might be a fresh infraction, which you were the first to notice?
The question kind of hung there. Ariane's implication was clear. If Cath-2 had witnessed anything of the sort, she ought to have reported it immediately, instead of sleeping for 10 hours and then making a harebrained effort to find Doc in a place where he wasn't.
No,
she said.
That's not what this was.
How do you know?
I was making passes over the lake for a long time. I was clearly visible. Anyone who was there for no good reason would have simply hidden in the trees until I was gone. That's not what this person did. They were down near the shore in a place where they could get a clear view of what I was doing.
Like what? Ariane asked.
Like they were gawking.
After a long silence, Ariane repeated the word.
Gawking.
Yeah. Until this point, Cath-2 had felt uncomfortable under Ariane's gaze, but now she looked directly into the great penetrating eyes for a while.
When this person moved, Ariane said, did you get any sense as to posture and gait?
I don't think it was a Neoander, Cath-2 said, shaking her head. That I would have reported.
Ariane blinked and said, the simplest explanation is, of course,
an indigen, which is the possibility I discussed with Belid. She was feeling a little on the defensive now. But what would one be doing there, so far from the nearest Riz?
It is a mystery.
Yes.
That explains why you broke profile, Arion said, nodding.
I don't even know what broke profile means to you people. Did you ever get the sense that you were being watched? Followed?
Arion Casablancova had the damnable habit of asking good questions.
You have to assume, when you're down there, that you are not going unnoticed by local megafauna, of course. Over time, hiking solo, trying to be aware of that, it can make you sort of, I don't know.
She didn't want to use the word paranoid around a Julian, since it was a racially charged word.
Arion seemed to sense this, and found it ever so slightly amusing. She leaned forward slightly, trying to help Kath too over the sticky place.
You developed a heightened awareness. Perhaps, to be safe, you interpret the sounds of the wilderness in the most conservative possible way, yeah. Like the morning of my departure, I was awakened by patches of light moving around my tent. I thought for a minute that it might be caused by the movement of a large animal passing between me and the sun. Then I emerged from the tent and saw that it had just been my imagination, that the light was shining between tree branches that were moving in the wind.
Interesting. That heightened awareness of things over a long enough span of time does seem just like the sort of stimulus that could trigger an epigenetic shift in a Moirin, Arion said.
The thought had occurred to me. You didn't mention it in your report.
This was the first time Arion had come out and admitted that she'd read the report, and so it pulled Kath too up short. She was distracted by a large Teclan entering the cafe with a green bracelet on his wrist. But it wasn't Belid. Just another surveyor, recently arrived, perhaps part of the same dragnet. Obviously, Belid had filed a very complete report, including his conversation with Kath too on the Flivver. From another type of person, she might have found this an irritating indiscretion, but for a Teclan it was to be expected.
I didn't mention it in my report, Kath too said, because in my judgment, it was only my imagination, not a genuine reportable survey event.
If you don't object to my going all juju, this was a self-deprecating term for Julian-style cognition,
go ahead.
Perhaps your initial impression was correct, and it was, in fact, caused by a large animal, a human, passing between you and the sun. A mistake committed by someone who was watching you furtively. And when he, I'll call him a he, noticed his shadow on your tent, he realized he'd blundered, and withdrew down the slope into the woods, and watched you from there.
It is entirely possible, Kath too said.
Out of politeness, she refrained from adding that it was the kind of thing that could only have been spun from a Julian mind.
How has your sleep been since then?
Very sporadic and jet-laggy, which is why I'm here. I think it is possible that I might have started to go epi on the last day, but now that I'm back in civilization, my system is confused, and the shift is being aborted.
Here, Kath too might have reached up to feel her own face, had she been sitting across the table from a Moirin friend.
Do I look different? But Arion would have no way of knowing the answer.
Kath too added, I've been sleeping with Belid. I think that is helping pull me back.
Very well. I hope your adjustment, whether or not it includes becoming Kath Amelthova III, is a smooth one.
Am I free to leave?
It's not my decision.
Your status remains indefinite.
Afraid I'll blab about it?
It's not for me to be afraid about such things. My personal advice? Don't blab about it.
But you know your rights. You can't be detained just because you think you might have seen a camouflaged gawker in the middle of nowhere.
Arion seemed to consider her next move before adding, Otherwise you'd see a lot more survey people bottled up in this cafe.
Arion was right about Doc. He had left his home in the misty campus of Stromness, a habitat in the predominantly Ivan part of the ring, consisting entirely of university, and was en route to Cradle. Along the way, he was spending a bit of time on the Great Chain. So when Cath 2 finally took the obvious step of getting in touch with him directly, he responded within a few minutes and told her where he could be found. At about the same time, the diode on Cath 2's wristband turned green, informing her that she was free to leave. She went to the room she'd been sharing with Bellad to find that he had already departed. She gathered up her sterilized possessions and went to the exit, where the robot that was the door inspected her wristband. Apparently it liked what it saw, because it unlocked itself and allowed her to pass through. At the same moment, the wristband sprang free and went dark. On her way out, she tossed it into a bin. Half an hour's floating along the eye passageways took her to the on-ramp, where she piled onto a capsule, along with 24 other visitors, strapped herself in, and was fired like a bullet down a gun barrel whose muzzle, at just the right moment, synced up with an arrival platform on the Great Chain. 1G of simulated gravity took effect as they were swept up into the rotation of the circular city. Attendants, stationed near the capsule's exit door, helped the new arrivals onto the platform and looked each one in the eye to make sure they were all right. People who weren't accustomed to sudden shifts in gravity were apt to suffer from dizzy spells, or worse. Most of the attendants were Kamites. This was a considered choice, ratified by many centuries of practice. Even the most hot-blooded Dynan would be willing to admit to one of these unassuming people that he was feeling woozy. The elaborate Dynan code of chivalry obliged them to show special politeness to Kamites, whom they identified as weak and childlike. Cath, too, walked with only minor unsteadiness toward the top of a moving stairway that would take her down to the mass transit level. The ceiling above was high and arched, like a grand old earth train station, and its nickel-iron fretworks were a twitter with birds, a whole society of them going about its internecine trends and controversies while keeping an eye on the human traffic below. Specialized sci-wise, wrapped around the struts and girders like pythons around tree branches, moved along at a rate too gradual for the birds to notice, cleaning off their shit. The birds were all the same species, called the grizzled crow, a small corvid, half of whose feathers were devoid of pigment, giving it a salt-and-pepper appearance. This feature had been added by its designers simply as a visual flag, so that they could be easily distinguished from rootstock crows. They moved in wheeling gray cyclones through the vaulted space overhead, but they were also comfortable shooting up and down the angled shafts that connected it to the transit level below. As Cath 2 walked along the platform, a single one of those birds peeled away from a spiraling and squawking murder and dove toward her. As it hied in closer, she became more and more certain that it was homing in on her face. It pulled up, just short of colliding with her, and, lacking a place to perch, hovered before her in ungainly style, treading air and slipping backward to match her pace.
"The grove in the temperate rainforest," it said, or as near as a crow could come to pronouncing those words, and then beat the air and took off, rising toward the rafters, but then banking hard down the slanted tube that would take it back into the transit. Nor was it the only grizzled crow that was completing such an errand. Similar encounters were happening all around her. Perhaps a score of the birds were perched on the safety railing that surrounded the entrance to the moving stair, muttering things that they had heard from humans. One of them, who perhaps had listened to a couple making love, was producing a crow's approximation of an orgasmic moan. Three of them were singing a popular song in unison. One was barking like a dog. A few were trying to catch food from people who were carrying snacks. One of them just kept repeating,
"Meet me at the train station at dot 16.
Another,
"I'll be wearing a red scarf."
At the bottom of the moving stair, the crows were flying in and out of the snug little rookeries that had been built for them at the ends of the tube cars so that they wouldn't foul the seats. 10 minutes on one of those cars took Cath 2 to Aldebrandy Gardens. This was a series of 6 consecutive blocks that had been constructed as botanical preserves. Each consisted of a rectangular slab of ecosystem covered by a lofty arched glass roof under which simulated earth landforms had been built. The temperature and humidity of each had been tuned to simulate a different part of old Earth. Plants and other organisms, sequenced from digital records, had been cultivated here, and supplemented later with birds, insects, and small animals. Creatures fostered and studied here had later been disseminated to factories in other parts of the ring, where they'd been propagated in vast numbers and used to seed new Earth. Starting at the hot end, Cath 2 walked through a Southeast Asian jungle, so humid that moisture condensed on her face before she could even begin to perspire. No sky was visible beneath its triple canopy, but when she stepped through the next airlock into Chihuahuan Desert, she was treated to a direct view up through its ceiling into space and blasted with sunlight bounced in by a robotic mirror mounted outside. Hanging up there in the center of the great chain was a little habitat called Sertzi. For during Cath 2's stay in quarantine, the eye had moved on from Akureyri, past the even larger habitat of Sean Probst at 20 degrees west, and was now entering a sort of boundary zone on the edge of the Cape Verde boneyard. She knew nothing of Sertzi, but it looked like a placeholder habitat, a sort of construction shed that would be used as the basis for something planned a minute or two west of here. Her skin and hair dried out instantly under the sun, and by the time she reached the end of the block, she almost wished she'd stayed below in the tunnels, where she needn't have worried about cactus spines and rattlesnakes. The next ecosystem was Fynbos, the characteristic environment of the Cape of Good Hope, cooler but no less sunny, a riot of scrappy flowering plants, a favorite of picnickers and bird watchers from elsewhere in the Great Chain. It was a little too crowded for her taste, and so she marched straight down its length, trying not to be distracted by its many small charms, and entered the next block. This was almost more aquarium than terrarium, being a simulation of old Earth Louisiana bayou. A plank walkway snaked among its moss-covered trees, carrying her over teeming reptile-infested waters to the airlock at its far end, where she stopped to pull a jacket out of her knapsack and don a pair of gloves. 800-year-old Douglas firs filled the next block from end to end. This one had been engineered to simulate the temperate rainforest of pre-zero British Columbia, so its roof had been equipped with filters that damped the sun down to a steady silver glow that seemed to come from all directions. The lack of shadows made it seem brighter in its way than the unobstructed sunlight in the Chihuahuan biome. Ferns, moss, and epiphytes grew on fallen logs so thickly that they seemed to have been sprayed from a hose. A skein of faint paths ran through it. Cath 2 followed one of them to the Coupole Grove, a relatively open space near the center, ringed by particularly enormous trees, where she found Doc, four of his students, his aide, and his robot, sitting on moss-covered rocks and logs. Dr. Hu Noah and most of his students were Ivan. In Doc's case, it was difficult to tell, since extreme old age tended to obscure racial differences. He'd lost his hair long ago, and his skin was blotchy from years spent down on the surface doing research in unfiltered sunlight. Limp skin dangled from his sharp cheekbones like wet laundry from the edge of a rock, and eventually joined into a system of wattles mostly concealed by a scarf wrapped round his neck. That, and other touches meant to keep him comfortable, had been seen to by his nurse, a stocky Kamite wearing a knapsack full of medical supplies. Curled at Doc's feet like a sleeping dog was a grab with a display panel in its back showing live readouts of his vital signs, which it was monitoring through a bundle of wireless connections. A pole projected vertically from its back to about the level of Doc's waist, where it forked to a pair of handlebars. It was a smart cane. When he grabbed the handlebars, it would help him stand up. It would then steady his locomotion, even on the roughest terrain, adding its six legs to his two. Doc's students ranged in age from 20 to 70. Cath, too, had never met any of them before. There was nothing unusual in that. The terraform was the largest project ever undertaken by the human race, and 99% of it still lay in the future. She recognized the oldest one's face from pictures in scientific journals. She felt awkward. Walking into the clearing and making herself known to these people had required a kind of courage. There was a class system within Terraform. Doc was at its apex. Survey personnel were not so much at its bottom as on its wild fringes, not so much looked down upon as looked at askance, seen as not entirely serious. But they were polite. All except Doc greeted her with the Ivan variant of the salute, an understated gesture that incorporated a suggestion of a bow. Doc held both of his hands out so that she could take them carefully in hers. He squeezed with surprising strength, and she squeezed back. Then suddenly they were alone. Whether by prearrangement or because the other Ivans had sensed something, they all withdrew. Even the nurse stepped away and contented herself with a stroll around the clearing, holding her hand up from time to time to check Doc's readouts on a palm-sized device.
"You're coming to cradle with me," he announced. "There is need of a team."
"A new research project?" she asked. Doc's eyes closed for a moment in disagreement, then sprang open, gazing at her directly.
"A 7, he corrected himself.
And I'm to be
one of us, yes."
Doc said this as if it were obvious, but it wasn't, not to Kath, too. A 7, a group consisting of one person from each race, was usually assembled for some ceremonial purpose, like dedicating a new habitat or signing a treaty. Not Kath 2's thing at all. And even if it had been, she was confused by the suggestion that she was to be in the same 7 as Doc. Because usually, when a 7 was being assembled, some effort was made to have all the members be of like status. And this was decidedly not the case between her and Doc. The gap in age, fame, and eminence was almost too wide to measure. What could possibly make Kath 2 special enough to deserve such an honor? Her confusion lasted only for a few moments before she saw it. So obvious. It was something to do with what she had seen on the surface. She saw faint amusement around Doc's eyes as he watched her figuring it all out. This turned to a mildly apprehensive look as he perceived that Kath 2 was getting ready to blurt something, and that alone caused her to stifle it. She said nothing. They would talk of it only when Doc felt it was time.
"You've never been to Cradle before," he said.
"That's correct."
"Well, it should be like a new kind of adventure for you, then."
"I'll try not to look like a tourist."
"Look like whatever you please," he said. "We'll be too busy to worry much about such things."
"When do we..."
12 hours, give or take," he said, and looked over to the Camite. "Is that about right, Memmi?"
Memmi nodded.
"Cabins have been booked on the elevator departing at 22:30.
Kath, too, hadn't met Memmi before, but had heard about this person of indeterminate gender who kept Doc alive and looked after many of his affairs. Memmi was short for Remembrance, a common Camite name. At the moment, Memmi seemed to be presenting as female, with a sarong-like wrap around the waist of a coverall that was otherwise utilitarian in the extreme, appearing to consist entirely of cargo pockets. Some neck jewelry and a turban-like head covering completed the ensemble. Her use of the passive voice, "cabins have been booked," was racially typical. Memmi, of course, had done the booking, made the other arrangements, and looked after the significant fund transfers needed to book a number of elevator cabins on short notice. But getting her to say that this had been her doing would have been like extracting teeth from her jaw. Some saw it as a becoming habit of humility, others saw it as irritatingly passive-aggressive. Kath, too, had no opinion. She had a few free hours on the Great Chain and needed to make the most of them.
"See you there," she said.
"I shall look forward to it,"
Doc answered. Kath 2 descended to the transit level at the end of the block and took the tube around the ring to a district of mid-rise blocks, full of stores, markets, coupoles, restaurants, and theaters, and spent the day drifting around, looking at things, buying little except for small items of clothing and toiletries she imagined she might need on the next leg of her journey. Square meter for square meter, This was the finest shopping district in the human universe, drawing its stock from every habitat visited by the eye, attracting the sophisticated and well-heeled natives of the Great Chain, as well as tourists from whichever habitats were currently in reach. She was feeling a kind of vague ambient pressure, enhanced, no doubt, by the advertising that walled her in on all sides, to buy clothes or try on jewelry or get a hairstyle that would make her fit in better on Cradle. That was a place for people more important than Cath, too. Brisk, poised paragons in uniforms or smart outfits, speed-walking down corridors in murmuring clusters, exchanging glances across lobbies. Cath 1 had been more susceptible to those kinds of social influences and would have been emptying her bank account at this moment, trying to silence the little voice in her head, telling her she wasn't pretty or stylish enough. But Cath 1 had died at the age of 13 and been replaced by Cath 2, whose brain had a rather different set of emotional responses. It wasn't that she was unafraid. Everyone was afraid of something. Cath 2 was afraid that she would make the wrong choices and make a fool and a spectacle of herself if she tried to dress up to Cradle's standards. Better to lurk, observe, and merge, as she did when flying in a glider. On her way back down to the tube, she happened to pass by a bookstall, where she picked up a paper copy of one of her favorite history books and downloaded a whole series of novels set on Old Earth. The paper copy was an extravagance, something she would add to her little library the next time she made it to one of her caches. For, like a lot of young Moirans, Cath 2 didn't even try to establish a fixed home. With a home came a social circle, and perhaps a family, all of which was fine for the people of the other races. But until a Moiran took a set, such permanent arrangements were unwise, placing husband, children, co-workers, and friends at risk of waking up one day to find that their wife, mother, colleague, or pal had effectively died and been replaced by someone else. So rather than renting apartments, young Moirans opted for storage caches in places they were wont to visit. Sometimes it was a shelf in a friend's closet, sometimes a locker in a survey or military base, sometimes a commercial niche in a big city with a robot doorkeeper that would ID you. Abandoned caches were legion, their contents forever being sold at auction. Cath, too, was the sort of person whose caches were apt to be crammed with paper books. For her, the electronic books were an insurance policy of sorts. The 4-day elevator ride might be nothing more than a prelude to further journeys, some of which might take her to places with little to no bandwidth, and nothing was worse than getting stuck in a situation like that, with nothing to read. Elsewhere on the Great Chain was a block-long historical museum, stacked by era, with one floor for each millennium, beginning with the pre-Zero world on the ground floor and proceeding upward. Of course, very few physical artifacts remained from pre-Zero, so that floor consisted mostly of pictures and reconstructed environments. But the Arkies had been allowed to bring a few possessions into space with them, and some of those had survived the epoch and the ensuing 5,000 years. So it was possible to look at actual smartphones and tablets and laptops that had been manufactured on Old Earth. They did not work anymore, but their technical capabilities were described on little placards. And they were impressive compared to what Cath 2 and the other modern people carried around in their pockets. This ran contrary to most people's intuition, since in other areas, the achievement of the modern world, the habitat ring, the eye, and all the rest, were so vastly greater than what the people of Old Earth had ever accomplished. It boiled down to a mystics. In the decades before Zero, the Old Earthers had focused their intelligence on the small and the soft, not the big and the hard, and built a civilization that was puny and crumbling where physical infrastructure was concerned, but astonishingly sophisticated when it came to networked communications and software. The density with which they'd been able to pack transistors onto chips still had not been matched by any fabrication plant now in existence. Their devices could hold more data than anything you could buy today. Their ability to communicate through all sorts of wireless schemes was only now being matched, and that only in densely populated, affluent places like the Great Chain. There was no telling, of course, what was going on in the Red Zone, between the turnpikes. Signals intelligence shining out into space from their part of the habitat ring suggested that the Aiedans were at least as advanced in their use of mobile communications as people here. Because they were also quite good at encryption, there was no way of telling what they were saying to one another. But Blue, for its part, had made a conscious decision not to repeat what was known as Tav's mistake. It was unfair, of course, for billions of people to focus blame on one representative of his culture who had died in a bad way 5,000 years ago. The epic, however, tended to have this effect on people's thinking. In the same way that certain people of Old Earth, raised on the Bible, would have referred to masturbation as the sin of Onan, those of the modern world tended to classify personal virtues and failings in terms of well-known historical figures from the era of the Cloud Ark, the Big Ride, and the first generations on Cleft. Fair or not, Tavistock Prowse would forever be saddled with blame for having allowed his use of high-frequency social media tools to get the better of his higher faculties. The actions that he had taken at the beginning of The White Sky, when he had fired off a scathing blog post about the loss of the human genetic archive and his highly critical and alarmist coverage of the Ymir expedition, had been analyzed to death by subsequent historians. Tav had not realized, or perhaps hadn't considered the implications of the fact, that while writing those blog posts he was being watched and recorded from 3 different camera angles. This had later made it possible for historians to graph his blink rate, track the wanderings of his eyes around the screen of his laptop, look over his shoulder at the windows that had been open on his screen while he was blogging, and draw up pie charts showing how he had divided his time between playing games, texting friends, browsing Facebook, watching pornography, eating, drinking, and actually writing his blog. The statistics tended not to paint a very flattering picture. The fact that the blog posts in question had, according to further such analyses, played a seminal role in the break and the departure of the swarm only focused more obloquy upon the poor man. Anyone who bothered to learn the history of the developed world in the years just before Zero understood perfectly well that Tavistock Prowse had been squarely in the middle of the normal range as far as his social media habits and attention span had been concerned. But nevertheless, Blues called it Tav's mistake. They didn't want to make it again. Any efforts made by modern consumer goods manufacturers to produce the kind of devices and apps that had disordered the brain of Tav were met with the same instinctive pushback as Victorian clergy might have directed against the inventor of a masturbation machine. To the extent that Blue's engineers could build electronics of comparable sophistication to those that Tav had used, they tended to put them into devices such as robots. Clef's initial population had been 8 humans and hundreds of robots, thousands if gnats were counted as individuals. Both numbers had expanded since then. Only in the last century had the human population pulled even with that of non-gnat robots. The end result for a young woman in a bookstall above a tube station on the Great Chain was that she was dwelling in habitats and being moved around by machines far beyond the capabilities of Old Earth. She was being served and looked after by robots that were smarter and more robust than their ancestors, the grabs and so on that Eve Dinah had programmed on Izzy. And yet the information storage capacity of her tablet and its ability to connect were still limited enough that it made sense for her to download books over a cable while that was easy, and to make room for them in the tablet storage chips by deleting things she had already read. That sorted, she rode transit to the off-ramp, where she climbed into a capsule, facing backward, and felt deceleration push her back into her couch as it was flung off the Great Chain into a tube lined with electromagnetic decelerators. Back now in the zero-G environment of the eye's non-rotating frame, she began to navigate its internal companionways, pushing herself along lighted tubes marked with the icon of Cradle, a pair of mountains enclosed within a semicircular dome. This led her, within a few minutes, to a transit station where she and 2 random strangers climbed into a 4-person bubble that presently went into motion and began to whoosh at greater and greater speed down a long and perfectly straight tube. They were traveling from the rim of the Great Eye's iris out to its inner vertex, the one closest to Earth, a distance of some 80 kilometers, and so hand-over-handing their way down a shaft wasn't an option. Kath, too, who had been awake now for something like 16 hours, felt herself dozing off. She jerked awake near the end of the trip, convinced that she had heard her name being spoken. The pod had a video screen on its front bulkhead, and one of the other passengers, to pass the time, had begun playing back a segment of the epic that must have taken place around 20 years after Zero. This could be guessed from the visible signs of aging on the faces of the surviving Eves, and from the fact that the first generation of their offspring were adolescents. This segment of the epic told the story of how a personal rift between Eve Dinah and Eve Tekla had been mediated and settled by some of the youngsters, led by Catherine Dinova. It was frequently pointed to as one of the first moments when the children of the Eves had begun to think and take action for themselves. Lines of dialogue from it were quoted frequently in modern-day discussions. Kath, too, wondered, as she always did, whether the people of the epic would have said and done some of what they had they known that 5,000 years later, billions of people would be watching them on video screens, citing them as examples, and quoting them from memory. Over the first few decades on Cleft, the cameras had died, one by one. Depending on how you felt about ubiquitous surveillance, the result had either been a new dark age and an incalculable loss to history, or a liberation from digital tyranny. Either way, it signaled the end of the epic, the painstakingly recorded account of everything that the people of the Cloud Ark had done from Zero onward. After that, it had all been oral history for about 1,000 years, since there had been no paper to write on, and no ink to write on it with. Memory devices were scarce and jury-rigged. Every single chip had been used for critical functions, such as robots and life support. A tone sounded, warning the passengers of deceleration, and the pod eased to a stop in the terminal. Even after it had come to rest, however, they experienced a mild sense of gravity. It was too faint to be perceived other than as an annoying tendency for objects not otherwise constrained to drift downward, where down in this part of the eye meant toward the earth. To prevent that drift from getting out of hand, some floors of lightweight decking had been constructed. But the gravity was still so faint that you could fly around by pushing off against anything solid. Kath, too, collected her bag, strapped it to her back, and glided out into the terminal. The other travelers from her pod seemed to know where they were going, and so she followed them down through staggered gaps in those decks. This part of the eye was bare bones, in an almost literal sense. It was where the massive structural limbs that held the whole thing together converged to a sharp point, aimed forever at Earth. The metal was honeycombed with tunnels and cavities engineered for various purposes. The carbon cables that held Cradle suspended above Earth's atmosphere, some 36,000 kilometers below, diverged here and ran taut through long, sheltered passageways all the way to the other end of the eye, where they came together again and emerged to connect with the big rock beyond. The passageways and chambers used by humans were tiny by comparison. Set into the very point of the eye was a glass dome, half a dozen meters in diameter. From it, you could look straight down the bore of the tether, which was actually a tubular array of 16 smaller tendons, and see the Earth. From this distance, the planet looked about as big as a person's face seen from across a small table. An old Earther, seeing it from here, might think at first that nothing had ever changed. It still had the same general look. Blue oceans, white ice caps, green and brown continents partly obscured by swirling white vortices of weather. Those continents stood in roughly the same places as the old ones, for not even the hard rain could make much of a dent in a tectonic plate. But the landforms had been radically resculpted, with many inland seas and deep indentations in coastlines, created by large impacts. New island chains, frequently arc-shaped, had been created by ejecta and by volcanic activity. The eye was always above the equator, Currently it hovered over a spot about halfway between Africa and South America, whose coasts echoed each other's shape in a way that made their tectonic history obvious even to non-scientists. The low-lying terrain along both coastlines had huge bites taken out of it, frequently with rocky islands jutting out in the centers of the bites, central peaks of big impact craters. Archipelagos reached out into the Atlantic, but trailed off well short of joining the two continents. The geography of New Earth, though beautiful to look at, made little impression on Kath, too, since she had been studying it her whole life, and had spent years tromping around on it. For now, her attention was captured by the giant machines in which the view was framed. Surrounding her, and just visible in her peripheral vision, was another of those ubiquitous tori, spinning around to provide simulated gravity for the staff who lived here with their families, looking after the tether and the elevator terminal. Inward of that were the 16 orifices where the tether's primary cable